You're very welcome to the best of News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty, and today we're listening back to an episode of the podcast called The Real House of Guinness. The famous brewing family was back in the headlines this year because the family saga was dramatised on Netflix, and we wanted to know how much of what we were binge-watching was rooted in truth and how much was dramatised for television. Novelist Emily Hourican joined me for that conversation. Her own series of novels inspired by the Guinness dynasty offers another window into this quite extraordinary family. But first, News Talk Daily reporter Alex Rowley went to the Dublin premiere of the show where he met three of its stars.
I think when stories are their best is when their time is. So it doesn't matter what time they're set in, because the emotions, the things that people are struggling with are all still current and all still applicable to today. And I think that what the series does really elegantly is, like, it's a really spicy time in Irish history where there's a lot of, like, political upheaval, a lot of protest, a lot of progress, and then it pairs it with this, like, modern soundtrack. So you have, like, Kneecap playing when the Fenians are on screen, because, like, the ethos of Kneecap, like, obviously represents the ideals of the people on the screen. And I think our history is so important, it's what made us who we are, and if we can tie that and get, like, a younger generation to, like, love that as well and see it as exciting, I think it's amazing.
I think people have just got to stop arguing and actually listen to each other. And we could say that about what's happening in the world politically. Stop seeking the differences and find the similarities.
Is it like every other Irish family where women are really behind the scenes keeping out now?
I think Stephen Knight really writes well for women. I think he grew up with very strong women in his life. I think he has always looked towards the historical dramas that he's written and seen that women have played key roles. They just were never documented. And that's why I think men and women come to his show and feel, oh yes, I can see myself in the avatar of that character very well.
You know, I think that the Guinness family in this show are not dissimilar to kind of any family at their core. You know, they fight and they make up and they argue, and they're really complicated, but not any more complicated than all of our families, or my family, which is perfect.
Any advice for any brother who might not be given the house, but somebody else is in the family?
Is this what's happening to you?
No.
Oh, right, okay. I guess, like, what Ben has to do is he has to fend for himself and carve his own path. And he, it's the first time he's kind of out on his own. So maybe, don't sweat it. If you don't get the house, it'll be fine. I don't know. Or maybe it won't. I don't know.
That was Daniel Galligan, Fionn O'Shea and Dervla Kerwin speaking to Alex at the recent premiere. So it starts, the opening scene, and I don't think I'm going to give anything away here, but it starts with the funeral of Sir Benjamin Guinness himself. So let's just go back, I suppose, and look at Sir Benjamin Guinness and who he was. He was the third son of Arthur Guinness, who of course founded the brewery back in 1759. But what else do we know about him and his ancestors, Emily?
This idea that family generational wealth is at all normal, you know, it just isn't. It is incredibly, incredibly difficult. Most family businesses barely survive the first generation, let alone on into successive generations. And it doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen without the real intelligence and acumen of the family members. Obviously, they get training in the business. But I mean, other than that, you need people who have an instinct. And Benjamin Lee certainly did. He took over what was a very successful brewing farm. But I mean, it was not without its hiccups. Nothing ever is. You know, there had been a period of time where the brewery had faltered terribly before he took it over. And he managed to grow it. He did really smart things like, you know, exporting to the UK, increasing the amount of product that they were able to put out there and get the money back in from. And he also began doing these very interesting things, which part philanthropy and again, part just this kind of shrewd business model. If you look after the people who work for you, they will work harder for you, partly because they will be loyal, but also partly because they will be healthier and happier people. They will be more able to work hard. There will be less casual labor because people will stick around and they will keep doing a job. They'll grow their expertise. They'll get better and faster at it. So these things, they were good for business. They were good for the brewery, but they were also good for the people who worked for him. And Benjamin Lee started the tradition of doing that. And he did it very effectively. He also spent a lot of money restoring St. Patrick's Cathedral, an enormous amount of money. And by the time he died, he had the biggest funeral the country had ever seen. And the series begins with that funeral. They depict riots at the funeral, which, you know, I'm not sure that there were many riots. I think that most of the people, it turned out in record numbers, were there to honor the passing of somebody who had made their lives better. I mean, also probably they felt they needed to go. There were, I mean, at least 500 brewery workers who were there. I imagine they probably felt it was politically expedient to show up and, you know, look sad at the passing of the man who was the head of the brewery.
So you mentioned there his philanthropy and his business acumen. I mean, he was pretty ruthless. There was an agreement in Dublin at the time, which most of the major breweries worked against, this price agreement. There was Darcy Anker and Sweetman's Phoenix and others who were there, all from Thomas Street in Dublin down to James's Street. I think you're all familiar with that and all of the Guinness signs. Well, they were all individual breweries, and there had been an agreement there basically not to undercut each other. But Benjamin leveraged his scale and the network of agents that Guinness had to ultimately to drive those competitors out, to ensure their collapse and to buy up all of those breweries. So he was ruthless enough too.
Ah, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt. And again, I guess, you know, what can you say except that it really worked out for him? It's harsh, but maybe that's just what business is. If you're not going to take the opportunities, then maybe you are like the businesses that do not survive.
At the beginning of the programme, you see the four children preparing for this funeral, and they're living in Ivy House, which is the Department of Foreign Affairs building, you know, that beautiful Georgian building on St. Stephen's Green. I mean, they were extremely wealthy, and they were part of a prosperous Protestant elite in Dublin, and there weren't many of them.
No, there weren't. I mean, the vast majority of the people who lived in Dublin were Catholic. There was, you know, even, I mean, there was a very, very small emerging kind of Catholic middle class. But for most of them, I think conditions were really pretty harsh. The gap between rich and poor, I mean, the gap between rich and poor now is horrific. But it was very, very bad then as well. We all have images in our mind of tenement life, because that is a side of Dublin history that I think we're all pretty familiar with. You know, we have seen, and that existed well into the era of photography being reasonably common. So we have all seen photos of, you know, families of 10 and 12 living in one room in a house where every other room is also occupied by families. And so we have a sense of what it looked like for poor people living in Dublin at the time, and contrast that with, as you say, you know, these scenes set in Ivy House. The comings and goings, the size of the staircase, the size of the hallway, the, you know, the casual splashing. There's a lot of casual splashing of whiskey from decanters into crystal glasses in the series. You know, people lounging on beautiful furniture. They really were. I mean, they were headed for huge wealth. Benjamin Lee was the richest man in Ireland when he died, when his son and the ultimate brewery successor, Edward Cecil, ECG, Edward Cecil Guinness died. He was also the richest man in Ireland at that time. So you do see them at the beginning of the series, and they have consolidated the early wealth. They're kind of on the route to grandeur. The wealth is done, and now they're heading into the world of the aristocracy. Benjamin Lee was, he had earned a baronetcy by the time he died. And then his son, one of them became Lord Ardilaun. But then the kind of main branch of the title, the second son, Edward Cecil, he was the first Earl of Ivory. So they got very, very grand after that.
And we talked about the opening scene here, which is the funeral of Benjamin Guinness. And there are those who are lamenting his death, and there are those who are celebrating his death. It appears he wasn't universally liked. So in the programme, there are those who are protesting because they saw alcohol as a scourge in Ireland at the time. And then there was the Fenian protest, who were protesting his links to Britain. How accurate do you think that scene was? And if it's not particularly accurate, does it at least reflect the political climate of the time?
I think that what it does is it brings together three things that did not necessarily happen in that way on that day. But certainly the temperance movement was really strong at the time. This idea that drink was the cause of great social ill, you know, and not entirely wrong, let's face it. But that was definitely a big thing at the time. I mean, this idea that the Fenians, I mean, yes, they were beginning to emerge. Like the Young Ireland Rebellion was 1848. So that's just 20 years before that. The famine is 20 years before that. I mean, 20 years is nothing. It's like the blink of an eye. And these things obviously had a huge impact on the kind of geographical and the social fabric of Dublin. There were so many more people who had moved into the city, desperately looking for work and for a means to keep themselves and their families alive. And there was the very early starting of a trade union movement, this notion that, you know, people collectively had strength that individually they did not, that the time had come to look for better, to ask for better conditions. I don't know that there were riots at Benjamin Lee's funeral, but these things were happening at that time. In his father's time, so in Arthur's time, Arthur was really supportive of the idea of Catholic emancipation, but he had voted against Daniel O'Connell. That got him, you know, people were throwing stuff at the brewery and they were trying to boycott Guinness in response to that. But it does show that this could happen.
Yeah, and that political backdrop is important because it does give context for a lot of what happens in the rest of the series. What also happens at the very beginning of the series is that we see the four siblings preparing to attend the funeral of their father. And there's hostility and animosity between the siblings from the outset. I mean, Stephen Knight, who wrote this drama, said the family had inherited, obviously, Guinness, but they faced a singular challenge. Don't screw it up. So in that environment, was that hostility there from the outset between the three brothers and their sister?
Again, I'm not sure how hostile they were. The central jumping off point for the series is the man dies, Benjamin Lee. He leaves this, you know, incredibly successful business. He leaves all of this money and all of these homes, and he makes the four people directly involved incredibly miserable, each one deeply unhappy because they did or did not get the things they wanted from the will. And the thing that he did was to leave the brewery jointly. So instead of leaving the brewery to his eldest son, he left it to two of his sons. He left it to Arthur and he left it to Edward. The idea then is that this kind of kicks off trouble, which is, according to the series, brewing anyway between them. Look, the next generation. So Edward Cecil left his brewery to his three sons. So, I mean, whatever Benjamin Lee started, Edward Cecil continued. He left it to Rupert, Ernest and Walter, who were the three sons, his only children. So he may have come to feel that it was not a stupid thing for his dad to do. I mean, that's kind of what I get from that, if he did the same thing. I think it's more interesting to watch family drama and conflict than it is. I mean, what is the Tolstoy line? All happy families are alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. I mean, it seems to me that from pretty early on, the division of interests was pretty clear between Arthur and Edward. Edward was all about the brewery. And he, like his dad, was seriously good at running that brewery. He did a really good job of it. Arthur seemed to be more politically minded. He seemed more interested in the kind of bigger picture rather than Edward was all about the day-to-day running of the brewery and how to make it more efficient and how to expand it. Arthur seemed to be looking in a different direction. And then there's the son, Benjamin, who in the series is the very much the troubled younger son. You know, he's the kind of wastrel. He's doing a lot of drinking. There's talk of laudanum, which to the best of my knowledge, is basically opium. It's an opiate. But then the actual will of Benjamin Lee is that he, at the time, that younger, the troubled Benjamin, had a commission in the Horse Guards. You know, he was kind of established on a completely different path and career in life, and therefore not included in the brewery because he was not around to have any interest in it.
There's actually a great line in the drama, because clearly Benjamin and the sister Anne, who we'll talk about in a minute, they were not left to manage the brewery. And the father apparently says, "I feel it is wise," this is in his will, "I feel it is wise not to burden Benjamin and Anne with the temptations that come with fortune."
I love that. That's really great.
What about Anne Guinness, his only daughter? I mean, she's left a diary, but she's not left the brewery either.
No, she's not. And I think it would be silly to get like overly exercised by that. I mean, she was female at a time when being female had very specific and limited value, you know, which is obviously shocking and awful. But there's no point thinking that by not leaving her a working share in a business, that Benjamin Lee was doing anything unusual. He wasn't. She was married. The feeling very much really seems to have been that married women were the concerns of their husband. They were no longer the concerns of their birth parents, you know, that she was set up for and provided for in life. It would have been weird. I mean, it would have been really worth writing and talking about if he had left her the brewery.
Yeah, but it would have gone, as you say, completely against the norms of the time. Let's look, I suppose, as you say, at the success that Edward Guinness, who was the youngest child, let's just look at the success that he made of the Guinness Brewery and the Guinness name. There was a brilliant line that I read. In 1879, the brewery was producing the equivalent of 244 million pints a year, just to give you a sense of how successful it was. By 1886, this number had jumped hugely to 392 million pints. So that gives you a sense of where he brought the business to. But what's also interesting, and I think we're probably going to see a second series of this, is the next generation of the Guinness family. And that's perhaps where you see a bit more of the colour and the scandal and the Guinness curse that they talk about. That's an area of interest for you, Emily, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I've written three novels about the glorious Guinness girls. So I'm slightly jumping to the generation after the one you were talking about. I've written three novels about the daughters of Ernest Guinness. So Edward Cecil's three boys, three sons, they were Rupert, who was the second Lord Ivy. They were Ernest, who is the father of Eileen and Maureen, and Una Guinness, who I have written about. And then the youngest is Walter Guinness, and he was father of Brian, who married Diana Mitford. I mean, at this point, there are huge intersections with the UK. So it's very much not just an Irish story anymore. For example, the three daughters, the three girls who I have written about, and so my novels are historical fiction. You know, they are taking the facts and bending them, although being very accurate, but, you know, filling the blanks in with my own imagination. And those three girls were brought up in Dublin. So they were brought up Glenmaroon over by Castleknock. But then they moved to England. I mean, once the kind of grown-up duties of their lives began, which still at that stage, this is now the 1920s, were to be married and to have children. Once that started, they were taken over to England. They were taken to London. They did the season. They were presented to the Queen. You know, all of those things that debutantes did back in those days, rich young women or well-born young women whose job was to get married. I always found it interesting that, you know, two of the three then lived pretty much permanently in Ireland when they were, you know, married and divorced in one case, but, you know, old enough to make their own decisions. They came back to Ireland rather than stay in London. You know, the early generation, it's all about the business and it's about the brewery and it's about, you know, really making, you know, firm stab at that. And then it all gets a lot more creative and artistic and slightly giddy. And as you say, this then is when the notion of the Guinness curse starts to come in, which, I mean, let's just say it now. It's like ridiculous, isn't it?
Is it though?
I think it's pretty ridiculous.
There were sort of mysterious deaths. There was a lot of public scandals. There were a few quite tragic accidents, were there not?
There were. There were all of those things. But surely by the law of averages alone, if you are talking about a family as big as the Guinnesses, and they are a very big family, there's a quote I found from an article written for Fortune magazine in 1930, right? So in 1930 already, the editor Debrett, so the Debrett guide to the peerage is like, It's the almanac for anyone who is interested in the labyrinthine twistings of the British aristocracy. It gives everybody's provenance. You know, the father was this and the mother was that, and this is the royal, the, you know, the family house and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, it's really the kind of go-to for anyone who wants to unravel these aristocratic families. And he said the Guinnesses were one of the most complicated families in the book. So that's going back to the 1930s. If you follow one line, so if you just follow Edward Cecil's line, and if you only go as far as his grandchildren, that's already 30 people. It's like a drop in the ocean of the entire Guinness clan. So I think that if you take the sheer volume of people, and if you add into that, I mean, we all know that money provides opportunities for danger in the form of things like fast cars and
fast lifestyles.
Okay, thank you. That's very good. Fast lifestyles. I don't want to sound judgmental about it, you know, but yes, fast lifestyles. I mean, I don't know if their tally of tragedy is any higher than really anybody's would be.
Just very finally, I want to talk about just one picture, which was the picture of the current Guinness family attending the premiere of House of Guinness. And in the lineup includes, you know, Daphne Guinness and Jasmine Guinness. And when I just looked at the picture, I would advise you folks to go out and Google it. I thought, OK, well, there's series 4 and 5 here as well, because the modern day Guinness family is just as interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, indeed, Daphne, a work, like a living work of art. Her clothes, they're not even clothes. I mean, the canvas of herself on which she puts these things is astonishing. There are so many interesting people. There are great writers. I mean, the daughter of Maureen Guinness, Caroline Blackwood, is one of my favorite writers. And actually, I think that one of the good things that will come from this is that her books will be republished, because she is a stunningly good writer. They are creative and interesting and talented. And I think, as you say, there is scope to go right through the next series of generations and in each generation find really great stories and also history. I mean, this is, you know, this is how history comes at us. I always prefer history mediated through character. I like knowing, you know, what a particular person was doing and how they intersected with the huge events of our time. Eileen, Maureen and Una, when they were like kind of 8, 10, 16 or so, there's a record of them standing in their house in Glenmaroon and looking out over, this is June 1922, and they are looking out across the city and they can see the fire, the smoke rising from the forecourts, which was being burnt in one of the very early acts of the Civil War. That, for me, you kind of go, it's all right there.
Emily Hurrican, author of the Guinness Girls novel, speaking to me on News Talk Daily. Well, thanks again for joining me on this Listen Back. I'll be here with another edition tomorrow. Until then, goodbye.